Good evening. Thank you very much for inviting me. Actually, you didn't invite me. You invited the Minister for Development. So I can appreciate your disappointment about getting me instead. But I'll do my best. Actually, we can be very, very proud of what the government is doing. And I don't mean the government in terms of the Conservatives and the Liberals who happen to be in charge at the moment, but almost alone amongst the rich countries of the world, the British government has made a commitment to development. It's committed itself to the United Nations target of spending 0.7% of the gross national income on development. The budget for the Department for International Development this year is £7.7 billion, and that's going to rise to about £11 billion by 2013. I think it can make us very proud of this country. There is an International Development Act that a previous minister, Clare Short, drove through in 2002, which means that the only thing that we can do with our development budget is reduce poverty. So whereas other countries have this great dilemma of how to play the aid budget, whether to spend it on promoting their own businesses, whether to sort of promote their own political causes, we can't do that. In fact, we get taken to court if people think we're doing it. The only thing we can spend money on is to reduce poverty. So we had a new set of ministers in charge. It's a bit like being in a company taken over by a new owner. And the new set of ministers came in, and they immediately focused on results. So Gordon Brown was, good at throwing money at the problem. What he liked doing was announcing that we've spent £1 billion on this or something else. The current set of ministers focus far more on outcomes. So how many children is your money, my money, our tax money, vaccinating? How many mothers are we preventing, saving from dying in childbirth? How many poor people are we opening up access to electricity, to decent sanitation, to schooling? How many jobs are we creating? That's the emphasis of the current Department for International Development. And they are pretty pragmatic. We are pretty pragmatic about how we get those results. So if we can do that by strengthening governments in poor countries, then that's what we'll do. If we can do that by working with civil society, with the charity sector, we'll do that. And if we can do it by working with the private sector, that's the way we'll do it as well. This evening we're going to talk a bit about the private sector. I just wanted to open, I'm probably about a third of the way through now. What is the private sector in developing countries? Well, can somebody give me a snapshot of what the private sector is in a developing country? Come on, guys, you come here this evening to talk about the private sector. Yeah.
Multinationals?
Sorry?
Multinationals.
Multinationals, uh-huh. Anybody else?
Local companies.
Local companies. Okay, so that's a sort of different extremes. I must say, the latter gentleman, my view is that in most developing countries, nearly everybody is in the private sector because the government just doesn't reach very far. You generally have quite poor, under-resourced, dysfunctional governments. So the private sector is your smallholder farmer. It's your agricultural labourer. It's your street vendors. It's the little garages, the little workshops. It's the small industries. That's your private sector. And all sorts of things stop that private sector from working, from employing people, from being innovative, from selling produce. There's normally a plethora of laws and regulations which are applied in an arbitrary manner, which means that your small traders, your farmers have to pay endless bribes to policemen, to the military to get things done. There's typically a lack of infrastructure. Imagine trying to run a business when you've got no electric current. There's a lack of access to finance. That's the lifeblood of most businesses, being able to borrow from the bank, being able to get investment. A great deal of businesses just have no access to finance. And there's a lack of access to markets. If there's no roads, there's poor communication, how do you sell your produce? And often there's unfair competition as well, because as well as the mass of the informal sector, you also have a few big companies generally, some multinationals, some locally owned businesses, and they're the ones, they're normally run and managed by the elite of a country who have cozy relationships with government. They're the ones that get the access to the government contracts, to the export permits. And then the multinational companies, which the young man mentioned, the Unilevers, the Anglo-Americans, and increasingly the Chinese or Indian multinationals coming in. Corporate social responsibility. What we were asked to talk about. Is this a useful tool? You're going to hear more about it from people more knowledgeable than me. But just what is corporate social responsibility? It's about companies behaving decently, not abusing their workers, not employing children for 12 hours a day, not chopping down forests or polluting rivers, not bribing officials and corrupting policemen, and as well as not doing things, perhaps investing in the local communities, building a school or a hospital or a local playground. So are these things useful? Are they valuable in the developing context? Well, yes, they are. They are highly desirable, and DFID and other development agencies support them a lot. Melissa is from the United Nations Global Compact. DFID is one of the funders of the United Nations Global Compact. We support the OECD guidelines on multinational enterprises, which seeks to set standards of behaviour. But valuable as corporate social responsibility is, I suppose our general view is that it's time to go beyond that. So corporate social responsibility, as I described it, is about not doing bad things, and it's about doing a few good things that are a little bit peripheral to a company's business. We are interested in changing core businesses, changing ways of doing business such that companies just, as they go about their work, as they go about the business of making profits, they generate benefits and opportunities for poor people. So they employ more poor people. They source their inputs from small companies or poor people directly. They use distribution channels that use local companies, use local employees. So new business models that are more inclusive of the community. An example of this that I think everybody knows about is fair trade, where you and I choose to pay a little bit more for what we buy in this country on the expectation that that will make the producers a little bit better off at the other end. But it's also about the way that mainstream businesses operate, as I say, working through deeper supply chains and using local distributors, sharing access to infrastructure. Lots of the big companies have their own medical services, sometimes their own schools, opening that up more widely to the communities they're in. There's quite a good article in a recent Harvard Business Review by the guru of business schools, Michael Porter and Mark Kramer, which talks about the new concept of businesses creating shared value for their shareholders and value for the community. Melissa's going to talk in more detail and give some really interesting examples of how inclusive business can generate benefits more widely. So how valuable is both corporate social responsibility and this sort of the new beyond CSR agenda, the inclusive business agenda? In trying to gauge how valuable it is, I would say that it is applicable mostly to multinational corporations and to large businesses. So its value in terms of catalyzing prosperity for the poor in developing countries will depend quite a lot on how important within a poor country multinational enterprises or big companies are. And that will vary from country to country. But my tentative feeling 4 weeks into my new job is that corporate social responsibility is important, but it probably gets disproportionate attention. We in the Department for International Development get dozens of letters each week from yourselves, from members of the public. I would say in the private sector area, the great preponderance of those is about corporate social responsibility. It's calling for us to do more on fair trade. It's calling us to bear down more on child labour. In general, it's trying to get the British government to use its influence to get companies to behave better, which is fine. As I say, we are all for that. But my assessment is that probably the greater challenge in developing countries is to get, as well as decent investment and decent business practices, it's to get more business and more investment. It's all very well to talk about companies treating their workers well, but there's a tremendous number of workers that don't have any jobs at all. It's all very well about giving a decent price to farmers, but there's an awful lot of farmers that just don't get their products to market at all because they haven't got the infrastructure. So I would like one of the results of DFID's new emphasis on working with the private sector, and I'm happy to talk in response to questions about the specific things that we do and are thinking of doing in that area, but I would like to see that resulting in a change in our mailbox and us getting more support for just generating more business and more investment in the poorest countries of the world to generate prosperity for the people who most need it. Thanks.
Ladies and gentlemen, the private sector, of course, plays a crucial role in poverty reduction through capital investment, technology transfers to the developing economies, and job creation. You might think, of course, that the opposite may be true in the light of the financial crash and the excessive risk-taking of the investment and retail banks in selling dodgy mortgage loans to those who patently couldn't afford them. Yet banking at its best includes microcredit to some of the world's poorest people. And I would urge you to see the short film Banking on Change about a friend of mine, a microcredit banker in Tamil Nadu. It was an award-winning film, and you can see it on YouTube. Tucked away in his footnotes, Gordon Brown writes in his new book, Beyond the Crash, quote, in America, there are now 8.5 million fewer people in jobs than in 2008. He was writing last year. In the poorest countries, 100 million more of our citizens are in poverty. From April 2008 to May 2009, he says, the fall in world trade was 20%. World output declined by some $1.5 trillion. And as you know, the banks had to be recapitalized and their toxic debts bought up by the US government to the tune of $700 billion. We are all paying the price in higher taxes and unemployment. The private sector creates wealth, but it can also create appalling poverty. But all is not lost. Matt Ridley, the author of a book on how prosperity evolves, writes in the Times recently that things are getting better. He quotes research from Columbia University, which shows that the last decade saw, quote, the fastest ever reduction in global income inequality. The world economy grew by more than 5% last year, and that is Africa's growth rate, while China and India, as you know, achieve growth of nearly 10%, pulling millions of their citizens out of poverty. Gordon Brown again, quote, "In the past three decades, 400 million Chinese people have escaped extreme poverty and millions have joined the middle classes." Ridley adds that despite the recent great recession, the per capita GDP of the world's average human being is now just over $11,000, up from about $8,500 at the start of this century. Growth, Ridley says, has a strange and telling feature. While in individual countries it jumps up and down, in the world as a whole it shows an inexorable steadiness. Of course, it is not evenly distributed within countries, and disparities between wealth and poverty can be dire. The ratio between the highest and lowest paid inside British organizations is over 80 to 1. In America, the ratio is far higher than that. Acute poverty in India is concentrated mostly in just 8 states, and together they account for more poor people than the 26 poorest countries in Africa. But then listen also to Ian Birrell, writing in the London Evening Standard recently. "Far from feeling gloomy in 2011, we should rejoice in the power of commerce and technology to transform lives. Wherever one looks, from life expectancy to literacy, from polio to poverty, from food production to the fighting of wars, the statistics are heading in the right direction." Birrell says that an estimated 925 million people go to bed hungry every night. But this is 98 million less than in 2009, despite global population growth. Birrell quotes the development economist Charles Kenny, whose new book, Getting Better, is just about to be published. "The number of people living on less than a dollar a day has almost halved in 20 years, while average incomes are at their highest level in history, having risen a quarter since 2000. Birrell puts this growth down to, quote, "more equitable trade, with technology playing a key role. There are, after all," he says, "more mobile phone subscribers in Africa than in North America." I worked in India for 3.5 years in the 1970s, and have been back there 10 times, including in the early 1990s when Manmohan Singh, then the finance minister, issued his first transforming budget. It liberated the Indian economy from the stagnantly low Hindu rate of growth. He cut tariff barriers and opened up the Indian market to foreign direct investment and international competition. This challenged Indian enterprises to improve their quality, productivity, and competitiveness in a global market, and had a transforming effect. India's private sector wants such measures to go further still. While tariff barriers are still twice the rate of China's, employers want the government to slash red tape, the so-called permit license Raj. I'm a journalist, and I'm not an academic or a businessman. So let me just tell you some stories to illustrate the role of the private sector in job creation and poverty reduction. Take the Tata Corporation, for instance, India's largest private sector group with some 100 companies. I was in the steel city of Jamshedpur in eastern India at the time of that first reforming budget. I wrote an article for the FT after visiting Tata Engineering, now Tata Motors, which is India's largest truck and bus manufacturer. I went around the huge factory and met the managing director and the trade union leaders. At that time, an independent academic assessment of Tata's had calculated that the output from that one factory alone was responsible for the creation of 4 million jobs throughout India due to the knock-on effect of employment of drivers and maintenance and repair workers. The Tata companies as a whole employ some 320,000 people. Over 38,000 of them volunteer 2 hours of their time each week to community development projects that assist the poor. Tata Steel in Jamshedpur brought India into the industrial area when its first ingots rolled out in 1912, nearly 100 years ago. Tata Tinplate Company leads the market in making the tin for food cans. But what is most striking about these and other Indian companies is their sense of social commitment. They run their own private hospitals for their employees and their families free of charge, and provide social housing and education for the children of employees in a country where the public sector social safety net is often non-existent. Tata's talk now not just about corporate social responsibility, but also corporate sustainability. Sri Gopalakrishnan, on the main board of Tata Sons, the parent company, says that Tata's constant mantra is, how does this affect the community in all their decision-making? In Pune, in the state of Maharashtra, they manufacture the Tata IndyCar hatchback. I drove it on their test track there. But guess what the company did first of all, even before they built the factory? Any ideas? They planted trees. That is a measure of the company's commitment to environmental sustainability. Car ownership in India is expected to rise fivefold in the next 10 years, from 14 million to 62 million. Now, you may or may not think that this is a good idea with the burning of fossil fuels, but it is a measure of the growth of India's middle class, which Goldman Sachs says, if you can believe anything that they do say, could rise from 5% today to as high as 50% in the next 30 years. Birol estimates that India will have 600 million middle-income earners within the next 20 years. Yet India also has more poor people than any other country, with 400 million people living on less than $2 a day. And over half of the employed population work in agriculture. What happens in India will determine the outcome of the Millennium Development Goal of halving the number of people living in absolute poverty by 2015. India's private sector plays a key role in all this and has seen huge investment growth in areas such as transport, social services, financial services, infrastructure, agricultural products, pharmaceuticals, biotechnology, and, of course, information technology and telecommunications. The two great IT giants, Infosys and Wipro in Bangalore, for instance, employ between them 230,000 people, jobs that didn't exist 30 years ago. Tatas, of course, are not alone in a commitment to corporate social responsibility. Mahindra and Mahindra, India's largest maker of tractors, supports the education of 37,000 girl children in economically deprived areas. And as you know, this is one of the most cost-effective investments that can be made in human and social development and poverty reduction. Educate a girl, and as she grows up, she educates a whole family in community and social values. Even a smaller company such as the Forbes Marshall Engineering Group in Pune runs its own hospital for its staff and the villagers nearby, charging a nominal 1 rupee, about 1/70th of a pound, as well as investing in the community. So I want to emphasize in all this the role of corporate leadership, human motivation, and transformational change in the boardroom. One reason why Tata's has such a reputation, and I'm not saying that they're faultless, is because of the vision and leadership of its founding father, Jamsetji Tata. He was trained in the values of the Parsi priesthood in his youth before becoming a textile businessman. In many ways, he paralleled the Quaker motivation of Fry's and Cadbury's here, as well as Sir Titus Salt of Saltaire in Yorkshire, where I grew up as a kid. The moral and ethical motivations of vision, care, commitment, integrity, and trust are essential in the corporate world if global poverty is to be addressed. And social entrepreneurship also encourages these virtues in the war against poverty Bill Drayton, the founder of the Ashoka Network for Social Entrepreneurship based in Washington, D.C., emphasizes that empathy is a key quality in good business leadership. The organization I represent is Co-Initiatives for Business, based in the village of Co in Switzerland. It is one of the programs of the Initiatives of Change movement. Our emphasis is to strengthen the motivations of care and moral commitment in economic life and thinking in order to correct economic and environmental imbalances and address the root causes of poverty. We run an annual conference on trust and integrity in the global economy, the next one being 2 to 8 August, and you're all welcome, of course. We also run similar training conferences for private and public sector enterprises in India at a conference center in the hill resort of Panchgani, south of Pune. Among our participants has been a Jamaican businessman, Roddy Edwards, who with his brother founded Walker's Wood Caribbean Foods, a social enterprise in the village of Walker's Wood near Ocho Rios. The Edwards family come from the white landed settler plantocracy, as they call it, originally plantation owners. And Roddy was aware of the history of white exploitation of blacks going back to the slave trade, as well as the huge privileges he was brought up with. He wanted to put something back into the local community. They started selling jerk seasoning and then raised the capital to build a modern food manufacturing plant in the rural community of Walker's Wood. They could have built it in the capital, Kingston, on the coast, which would have been better for exports. Instead, they wanted to create rural jobs for a rural economy. The factory created a market for some 3,000 farmers across Jamaica. Now that is good motivation towards poverty reduction. Then in Zimbabwe, there is a small agricultural company called AgriBiotech, run by Dr. Ian Robertson from Edinburgh. It employs agricultural scientists from the University of Zimbabwe in Harare. They found a way of tackling the blight in potatoes and cassava, which rots them in the soil. They market fresh cuttings to resettlement farmers across the country with the support of aid agencies. The UK Department for International Development has rated their work very highly. They've calculated that they've been able to feed 3 million people in Zimbabwe with a basic staple diet at a time of acute food shortages under the Mugabe regime. Dr. Robertson told me that he could have earned up to 100 times his present salary if he joined an American university. But he and his wife felt a sense of calling to serve in Africa, and they've never deviated from it. That is also good motivation towards poverty reduction. And you could read these stories in my book, incidentally. Ladies and gentlemen, international companies too often perpetuate corruption in the race to win contracts, highlighted by the anti-corruption body Transparency International through its annual Corruption Perception Index and indeed Bribe Givers Index. The British government is only now catching up on passing legislation to outlaw the bribery of foreign public officials, following the USA's Foreign Corrupt Practices Act of 1977. There is the ancient saying that the poor you will have with you always. It's a realistic acknowledgement that wealth and poverty are relative to each other. But what the private sector does is to help to provide investment, skills, jobs, and wealth in the sense of the common weal or the common good. The emphasis needs to be concerned with balancing the interests of all stakeholders and not just the relentless pursuit of shareholder value and quarterly reporting. And the stakeholders include not only the owners, employees, customers, and suppliers, but also the wider community in which companies operate and the environmental legacy left for future generations. Adam Smith wrote not only The Wealth of Nations, but he also wrote The Theory of Moral Sentiments. He talked about the vice regent of the deity, what today we might call the conscience. There are some principles in human nature, Smith wrote, which interest the human being in the fortune of others and rend their happiness necessary to him, though he derives nothing from it except the pleasure of seeing it. Integrity, honesty, and a concern for the common good all create trust. And such values are essential tools for good business practice. They are also the best motivation for the private sector in the war against poverty. Thank you.
Thanks very much for having me. I'm a Canadian. I actually went to grad school in the UK, so it's nice to come back and see a full room of students on a Friday night. So I'm glad you guys are all interested in the issue of business and poverty. Like you, a number of years ago now, for me, I was quite interested in the dynamics between the private sector and the public sector and how we could better leverage what companies can do, not only their resources on the financial side, but also the capacities that they have, their business models, the way that they approach problem solving, and how we can better leverage that to actually solve some of the world's most challenging problems. As we all know, the UN has been working for many years, as have many governments around the world, to try to solve problems with regard to poverty issues. And I think, you know, obviously there's still a lot of problems in many developing countries around the world, but I think hopefully after my 10 minutes or so, you'll have a good idea of what the UN is doing more to work more closely with the private sector and the ways in which we've seen a significant progress, not only by the UN in actually engaging the private sector in its work to try to reduce poverty around the world, but also in the private sector to actually start thinking more around how the communities that it operates within are integral parts of its business and the success of its business over time. And I think I'll complement a lot what the two previous speakers have said, that I think at the end of the day, what we're really driving for in the Global Compact is really looking at how can the private sector, through their core business activities, really contribute to peace, development, human rights, and make a great profit at the same time. And it's really that nexus that I think I'll also talk about. So I had sort of constructed this for a bit longer, so I'm going to maybe skip over a few slides to give more time for questions and answers. But what I did want to talk about is just a little bit of showing you how UN business collaboration has changed, even over the past 10 years, which is how long I've been working for the UN now. When I first started at the UN, people were not even really interested in talking to me because they knew I was doing something with the private sector and they knew the private sector was evil. So why would we, you know, why would we bring those, you know, company people into our, you know, ivory tower that was the UN? And I think there's been a substantial change over the past 10 years in terms of how willing and open the UN is to engaging with the private sector. And you'll see Secretary Ban Ki-moon often talk about the importance of the private sector if we are to achieve the UN goals, the Millennium Development Goals, et cetera. I'll give you a little bit of an overview of what the UN Global Compact is and what we do. I've worked for the Compact now for almost 9 years, so almost since it was launched. And then I'll talk a little bit about how we work with the private sector, what we do to help them improve the way that they're operating and also contribute to the societies that they're operating within. So with that, this slide just gives you an overview of the overlapping interests between business and the UN. I think, as we all know, in this interdependent world that we're now living within, although the aspirations of the UN and the mission of the UN, peace, development, human rights, is different than the profit motives of the private sector, increasingly we can see that there are significant overlapping interests between business and the UN. Significant issues such as climate change, such as AIDS, all of these kinds of issues are not only public sector concerns, but they're also impacting the private sector and how they're able to do their business. If a company's operating an environment and all of a sudden conflict breaks out, you know, obviously that lack of stability causes significant costs for the private sector. So as we've seen issues from good governance, security issues, to issues around how to build markets, increasingly we realize that the objectives of the private sector, though different than the objectives of the UN, there are significant overlapping interests where both the private sector and the UN can come together to actually try to solve some of the issues. I wanted to also talk to you a little bit, and I don't want to throw up too many slides with a lot of diagrams, but I think this triangle is a great way of thinking about what are we talking about when we're talking about corporate responsibility, corporate citizenship, CSR. I think often some people think of corporate responsibility simply as this bottom part of the triangle. You know, and I think back in the day, companies also thought of it like that. Doesn't matter what I'm doing in my regular business, I'm going to be a good person and give $1 million to help build a school, and then I'm still going to go about my business in the same way with my child labor, polluting the rivers, et cetera, et cetera. And I think this bottom part, which is really just philanthropy, although it's helpful and great, I mean, it's great to give money, it's great to help build schools and hospitals and roads, et cetera, I think increasingly we found that that's often the first budget that gets cut in the private sector when things, you know, turn differently for the company. So if we are to really start getting companies to be more strategic about how they look at these issues of social and environmental and governance issues, we then sort of step to the next level, which is really looking at these issues from a risk management perspective. And those are a lot of the examples that you often hear about the private sector. I don't want my pipeline to get blown up, so I want to do a stakeholder engagement, community engagement process. I want to make sure that the way I build my pipeline doesn't interfere with inter-community issues. You know, that helps my business because I'm, you know, less likely that my pipeline's going to get blown up. So these are issues that a number of companies are now really looking at. And I think strategically you'll see a lot of companies looking at these issues, not only I think from strategically it being important to their business because their CEO is interested in these issues, but also because big mainstream institutional investors are asking companies about what they're doing. Increasingly they're recognizing that risks to the business not only stem from the traditional financial issues, but also start arising as it relates to social and environmental and especially governance issues as well. So I think we're also seeing big mainstream institutional investors driving companies to think more strategically about these issues. And that then connects with the top part of the triangle, which is really what Gavin and some of the other speakers were talking about. What are the ways that companies can really look at expanding their business, developing new business models to serve the poor, and really being strategically and fundamentally different in the way they do their day-to-day business? That means not only the fact that they're respecting the human rights of their workers, that they're not polluting the environment, but they're also looking at ways in which they can serve underserved markets. And I think that's also a new area where we're seeing a lot of companies start looking at these issues, but that's a more strategic opportunity for business, I think, to really expand not only the contributions to poverty, but also as a way to grow their business. So that's the arrow. The Global Compact. What is the Global Compact? I won't spend too much time on what it is. It's an initiative launched by Secretary General Kofi Annan in 2000. It's rooted in 10 principles in the areas of human rights, labor, the environment, and anti-corruption. We started off with only 40 companies 10 years ago. We now have over 7,500 participants from 135 countries around the world, from the big multinationals, the Coca-Colas, Anglo-Americans, Unilevers, to small and medium-sized businesses in Pakistan, Brazil, China, Tanzania, you name it. So we're really focused on how can we engage the private sector more, how can we help them change the way that they're doing their day-to-day business to respect those 10 principles. I completely agree with the previous speakers. One of the big challenges is getting companies to invest in these difficult environments. And of course, we want more investment, but we also want responsible business. And so I think that's a really important an important aspect of the Global Compact. The two complementary objectives. The first, when companies join the Global Compact, they commit to implementing the 10 principles into their day-to-day business practices. So really changing the way that they're doing their day-to-day business. Not just giving money, but really looking at their supply chains, their suppliers, the influence that they have over their suppliers, and really looking at how can they ensure that they continue to improve their progress on these issues. So that's really the internal dimension of the Global Compact. The second objective of the Global Compact encourages companies to take action in support of UN goals, and that includes development, the Millennium Development Goals, et cetera. So this is really both the internal and the external dimension of what we deem to be good corporate citizenship. And this is what companies commit to when their CEO sends a letter to the Secretary General of the UN committing their company to the Global Compact. What's expected of participants when they join? As I mentioned, there's a CEO commitment from the board of the company. I think it was also mentioned one of the important drivers of corporate responsibility is that the CEO has to be on board with all of this, otherwise it's going nowhere within the company. And also increasingly, we're seeing the important role that boards have. Once the CEO changes, if the board buy-in wasn't there, we notice a huge difference in the engagement level of that company with the Global Compact. So increasingly, we now ask companies to actually ensure that their board signs off on that commitment before they join the initiative. Secondly, the letter has to go from the CEO of the company to the Secretary General of the United Nations. And that leadership commitment really helps drive the company's engagement in the Global Compact. We really see the important role of that leader being engaged as an important driver. Willingness to engage in continuous performance improvement, open to dialogue, participating in events, all the types of activities that companies can engage in with the Global Compact is voluntary. However, there is an annual reporting requirement. And for those companies that are in the Global Compact, they are required to annually report on their progress. And if they don't report, they're kicked out of the Global Compact. So in the early years, I don't know whether many of you have heard about the Global Compact in the past, there was some criticism by NGOs and others saying, well, companies sign on to this thing, but it's all voluntary. So what happens if they don't live up to their commitment? It's true that we don't monitor or audit companies. We're not in a position, nor do we have a mandate to do that. But by making companies report in their annual reports, their sustainable development reports, then other NGOs and UN partners that are also part of the Global Compact can hold the companies accountable for what they claim to be doing. So there is an important accountability mechanism here whereby if the companies don't report, they're kicked out. And in fact, we've now kicked out, unfortunately, just over 2,000 companies over the past 10 years. So it is true that there are a number of companies that have joined the Global Compact and have not lived up to their commitment to implement the principles and report on their progress, but we still have, you know, well over 7,000 who are doing it. So that's an important aspect of the initiative to mention. Just to give you a quick overview, this is where we have Global Compact local networks in countries around the world, and where we have emerging networks, just to give you a bit of a screenshot. We still are pretty weak in Africa, as you can see. Although some countries in Africa, notably Sudan, where we have a network, was certainly quite a challenge to get that going, and I'm happy to talk a little bit more about that in the question and answer period. So one other thing I did want to talk about is how far can corporate responsibility really go? And I think by explaining a little bit about the Global Compact and the fact that it is a voluntary initiative, often people question, you know, how far can a voluntary initiative really go in changing corporate behavior? And I think my main point here and my view is that the Global Compact certainly shouldn't be seen as a substitute for regulation and appropriate regulation and appropriate roles of government in the world. But I think it also is an important opportunity for business to help drive these issues and to stimulate business to be more innovative in their approach to these kinds of issues, to actually engage them in a voluntary way. So I think the Global Compact is designed to really encourage companies to continue to improve their progress. It's not a seal of approval. It doesn't mean that the company is fantastic if they've joined the initiative, but if a company has committed to the Global Compact, they've committed to continue to improve their progress as it relates to the 10 principles. And I think that's an important dynamic. It's really about working with the United Nations and other stakeholders to continue to improve your work in this area. So it's not a substitute for regulation, but nor is it a PR exercise. As I mentioned, companies have to report on exactly what they're doing and are held accountable for that. Moving to the Global Compact for Development, This is the framework that we use when we talk to our participants about how they can engage on poverty reduction issues. I've already talked a lot about core business, and I think that's one of the main ways companies can do it. At the end of the day, we say invest, be responsible, and make money so you can create jobs. I mean, at the end of the day, that's the greatest contribution a company can make to poverty reduction around the world, period. In addition, it's also great if your philanthropy and the way that you're giving money is strategic, and you know that it's connected with your business, but it's also connected appropriately with the communities that you're, you know, attempting to give to. We've all heard the stories of, you know, people building a bunch of schools and then there's no teachers to even teach in the schools. So, you know, those philanthropic contributions are simply gone to waste. So the importance of actually designing your philanthropic programs in ways that reinforce the needs of local communities is critical. And I think we're seeing that more and more from a lot of companies. And finally, the last piece, which I think is also really important and underlies a lot of these issues, is really what companies are doing as it relates to public policy engagement and advocacy and how they're lobbying the government and for what. And I think we can see that a lot as it relates to climate change issues. Often companies say one thing, and behind the scenes, they have people lobbying the government to ensure that the laws stay exactly the same, especially notable in the U.S., actually. Company examples, I won't go into too much detail because I'm already probably taking up a lot of time, but I did want to just profile a few here for you. I know you can read them yourselves. But things like, you know, Sumitomo Chemical, who makes bed nets, anti-malaria bed nets. Normally, they have factories in Vietnam because they can do it really cheap there. The company starts thinking about, actually, if we built a factory in Tanzania, not only could we make our product there, maybe it costs us a little bit more, but we can actually create jobs for a lot of people there. And so, you know, getting companies to think about the ways in which they can still do their core business, make money, and at the same time, create jobs in countries where they maybe wouldn't otherwise be thinking about investing there are really interesting, I think, new approaches to these issues. I won't go into any more detail, I think, on that. Pretty self-explanatory. Uh-oh. Huh. Well, that's maybe an indication I'm speaking too long. I think those slides were just giving you examples of what are the kinds of initiatives that the Global Compact has in terms of engaging business. We do everything from an initiative called Caring for Climate, where companies join and actually share their experiences and new technologies and new approaches to reducing their CO2 emissions. We have an initiative on business and peace, as I was mentioning, that I lead our work on. It involves a lot of extractive companies, financial institutions, looking at how companies can contribute to peace and development while at the same time doing good business. So we have a variety of different initiatives. We also have something on anti-corruption, an initiative on anti-corruption, which links to the 10th principle of the Global Compact. Again, corruption being one of the biggest challenges in many developing countries. And I think that's also an important area that I won't go into detail, but if you're interested in the question answer. So just lastly, to end with sort of the two key challenges from my perspective on the UN side in terms of how we can actually better work with the private sector and engage the private sector on poverty reduction. The first is, I think we really need to further enhance the capacity of the UN and business to work together. Back in the day, I think for various issues, from language issues to even bureaucracy issues, business and the UN often function at very different speeds and in very different ways. And although there's been some great progress, I think notably you can see that from the Global Compact Office, I think the UN still has a ways to go in terms of actually more effectively being a more effective partner with the private sector in projects on the ground that it's engaging with. And finally, I think the other point, which I think Gavin also mentioned and I wanted to also end on, is really at the end of the day, we're trying to encourage companies to make responsible investments even in challenging operating environments. And this includes the least developed countries of the world. So looking at ways in which we as the UN can, together with the private sector and civil society, reduce the risks to business of operating in these environments so that they can be successful businesses and sustainable businesses over the longer term. And I think that, at the end of the day, is what everyone is trying to work towards. So with that, I would like to thank you very much for your attention and happy to answer questions.
Good evening. I know it's already quite late on a Friday evening, so I think the most interesting part of this evening is the Q&A. I'm here from, as I believe I've been introduced, kind of the world of business, the world of money. So I'll be talking to you a little bit about money. And I think also really the topic here is corporations and poverty, the haves, the have-nots, a lot. In the words of Paul Daniels, not a lot. In terms of what is a lot and what is not a lot, I guess the context is very important. Perhaps for a little bit of audience participation, I'd like to have a little quiz with a cash prize. It's an immediate cash prize, and it's a crisp new £5 note. And this £5 note is being awarded to the first person who can tell me, and now we've got your attention, who can tell me, panelists are barred from answering this question, I should say, how much is 1 shilling? One shilling. No, sorry, an English shilling, I should have said that. An old-fashioned coin of the realm of the United Kingdom, a shilling. Does anyone know? Does anyone want to Google it? 5p, someone says 5p, and we have a winner. Round of applause. Okay, so that's the first cash prize of the evening. It might be the last, we'll see. Now, why I asked that question is it was Winston Churchill who said 5 shillings, which is 25 pence, is not a lot unless you don't have it. So really here the context is if we have a lot or not a lot. Now I'd like to start by talking really about corporations and poverty. And really what is the role of a corporation? Well, a corporation is really an existence to act in the best interests of its shareholders. Are these interests compatible with helping to get rid of poverty? Well, my view is they are. We've heard a lot already this evening about corporate social responsibility, and I think Gavin put it very well about it's about decency, it's about behaving correctly, and as I put it, doing the right thing. We're seeing more corporations, and Melissa had some great examples of corporations. I've got just one here, Unilever, 300,000 jobs created. To me, this is all about how can the genuine casualties of society be safeguarded. And I have, I think, an idea and an approach and a solution as to how we can do this. Has anybody here heard of a man called Bob Wilson? Hands up if you have. Okay. Well, Bob Wilson was a footballer. There'll be no reference this evening to Sky Sports. But Bob Wilson was a footballer in the 1970s. He played for Arsenal. And he was a commentator as well on ITV Sport. And unfortunately, about 11 years ago, his daughter, who was a nurse, contracted a form of leukemia, and she died. And Bob and his wife set up a charity called the Willow Foundation. And the Willow Foundation provides support, special days for seriously ill people of age between 18 and 14. And I'm lucky enough to know Bob pretty well. It's one of the charities that my company, Eurovestec, has gifted shares to. And this is what Bob said about what I'm going to talk to you about and how we can hopefully all make a difference. And we've got here the words capitalism and the greater good. Now, there are a lot of people who will try and make out that those are contradictory. It's my view that they're, in fact, complementary. And here are a selection of just some of the charities that have already benefited from this initiative, which I'll just come on and explain to you in detail and perhaps conclude by how you can help and get involved and get this thing moving further. This is called share gifting. And in simple terms, what we've got is companies, listed public companies, creating and gifting new shares. My own company, which are four people in London, in central London, and we've been going 11 years, we're not a big company, we're only capitalised on the stock market at around £50 million. But we've given away £1.8 million in the last 10 years to, as I said, nearly 100 charities. And we say the donation, the only condition is there are no conditions. The charities get on and do what they're best at. Now, the cost for companies is negligible. We can do it in the Q&A, but basically the cost is the par value of the shares. We can go into a lot more detail if you like. And there is some very modest dilution because there will be a few more shares in issue. This applies, as I said, to listed companies, and they create and gift new shares. I mentioned Sir Winston Churchill a little bit earlier, and this is what Sir Winston Churchill said, and I think it applies to the whole concept of gifting and giving. Why do people give? Well, we're not, I guess, here tonight to talk about the human psychology of why people give and do the nice thing and the decent thing and the correct thing, but it's something that people do, and I think that really does make a difference. Now, I said earlier about how much is a lot, how much is not a lot. Well, in the world of the city, we talk about companies typically in billions, market capitalizations of companies, broadly to be in the FTSE 100, which is the top 100 companies in the UK, you have a market cap of around £2 billion. That's 2,000 million pounds. Now, if you were to imagine that each company in the FTSE 100 decided to do what I'm suggesting, and that is to create and gift in a year, and hopefully every year, a tenth of 1% of their shares in issue, which I think is a rounding error, and gifted those shares to charity. Any ideas what that might come to? Before the button is pressed, because we've got a Q&A, 5, 4, 3, 2, no cash prize for this one. Meets with silence. Well, the value is £1.7 billion. Now let's talk about, I'm not from a bank, I'm not an investment banker, don't get me started on my views on investment banks, but if we took there are four companies in the UK, and it's not fair to tar them all with the same brush. There's HSBC, there's Lloyds, there's the Royal Bank of Scotland, and there's Barclays. Now, if those four banks said, we will each year create and gift a tenth of our number of shares in issue to charity, what would the impact be? What would the impact be on the share price? Well, theoretically, the share price may go down by a tenth of 1%. Does that make a huge difference? Is that a lot? Well, I don't think it is to the owners of the companies. And our shareholders are some of the top institutions in the United Kingdom, and they're very supportive of what Eurovestec has done and the share and share alike concept. Well, if the four banks I've just mentioned were to do the same, that would come to £205 million a year, which in my view is quite a lot. So I've just pressed the last slide, but all it said was two words, which were gift shares. And I think really my solution, and where I think it needs not just an idea and one company to do it, but for other people to do it, and a groundswell of opinion and pressure from people who care to make it happen, and hopefully that's where you come in, to lobby, to put pressure on corporations to do the right thing and to truly make a difference. Thank you.